And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5. I'm Phil Taylor, your host, and with me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil. And can we thank all of our listeners for their wonderful generosity. And, you know, we're almost there.
Almost there, $5,000.
$5,000 to go.
And short of the great goal.
We've met the goal, which is wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll come back to that. So you could just go to CIUT.fm, by the way, if you want to help, just toss in $5,000, round it off nicely. Today on the show, we're going to be talking to a lawyer in Virginia, Ophelia Calderon. She is representing Leon Munyakazi, who is scheduled for removal from the United States. He is yet another one of a Rwandan national who is being victimized by a government which is very chummy with the U.S. administration. Therefore, he's one of those who criticizes the government of Rwanda or has different opinion. And he's in hot water, and we want to talk about that. And later in the program, we will be speaking to Father Claude Lacay. He has a new book, The Rebel Priest. He's going to be at Beth Zetoun here in Toronto, Beth Zetoun on the 20th. That'll be Friday at 7 o'clock, and we'll be talking with him. And in the interim between our discussion with Ophelia Calderon and Father Lacay, I've decided to call him. I don't know, sometimes priests don't want to be called Father, particularly by folks like me. But anyhow, we will have something to say about the events over the weekend. And Benar can tell you our sympathies go to the people of Beirut, the people of Paris, the people of Russia who had heavy losses recently, and to the great city of Damascus, which has been for 4 years under siege from these Europeans might call them berserkers. There is a history of such people in Europe. At any rate, the assaults on all those places have taken many lives. We're learning the lives of those in Paris. I hope someday we'll be sufficiently civilized to learn the names of the victims in Beirut and Damascus and elsewhere. But right now, I believe we are joined by Ophelia Calderon. Are you there?
I am.
Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
By the way, you practice law in Virginia, in Fairfax, I believe. You have a client who is getting attention, is being spoken of in many circles. He's a Rwandan national, and he's facing removal/deportation from the United States. And rather soon, my understanding is he's someone who has he's a scholar. And so I'd like to get, first of all, I guess, the background. Could you tell us who Leon Munyakazi is? Give just an idea of who he is.
Well, Leopold Munyakazi an academic, first and foremost, and he came to the United States in 2004 for a teaching conference. And while he was here in the United States, he learned that he was on a list of people considered to have divisive ideas.
Mm-hmm. A list? I mean, so how does that work? Someone walks up to him and says, "Your name is on a list?" How does that?
I mean, this is actually fairly common, actually, in a lot of countries where there are dissidents and, his case is not unique. I mean, this is something that I've heard of before, you know, and obviously asylum is a big part of my practice, of pretty much any immigration attorney's practice, where the government indicates that there are people who maybe are not pro-government.
Uh-huh.
Right, in the kindest possible way. Right,
I suppose he might not be. Yes,
right, exactly. So, I mean, other people who are in the government who may or may not be. This is more of a general thing, right? I mean, you might find that there may be people in the government who may or may not be pro this type of action, and so they share that information with others. Like, hey, listen, I've come across this list. I happen to know that these people are in danger of either being arrested or, you know, are being targeted for having divisive ideas, and that's essentially what happened with Leopold.
So was he here to lecture, or was he didn't have any other status? He applied for some status. What did he?
He was on a tourist visa to go to a teaching conference in Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. So he, you know, like any academic, right? I'm gone to a conference. I'm going to, you know, learn new things about teaching, et cetera, or, you know, share ideas, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then while he was here, he was informed about this list, and so he elected to apply for asylum from Rwanda.
Uh-huh. Now, he would seem, his story includes, I'm looking at the details, a rather surprising fact that he was in Rwanda in 1994, in October, as I understand it, he was rounded up or put in a jail, as thousands and thousands and thousands of Rwandans were.
Yes.
But is it so that he was 5 years in prison, was never charged, and never had a trial?
That's correct.
Incredible.
Mm-hmm. He was taken
so if anybody would be clear, settled as to who they were, 5 years by a new, very authoritarian type state, liking police work, liking investigation, et cetera. They never even charged him?
That's correct.
Yeah.
They never charged him. I mean, and there are details of a investigation that they did in 98 and 99. I mean, you know, obviously when they were investigating the potential for people to be active in the genocide, I mean, they were going around to particular areas and saying, well, what is your knowledge of this person and whether or not they were involved? And they did that with Leopold's case. And, you know, there were a number of people that they interviewed, and that information was provided to me at some point during this proceeding. And those individuals, the individuals that were interviewed in 98 and 99 clearly stated that he had not been involved in the genocide or anything like that.
So there was exculpatory witnesses, people who did say, I mean, it wasn't as though there was no investigation. There was some, and people had spoken who would have been at the places where things were alleged, and they
yes.
said, no, he was not involved.
That's absolutely correct.
And so then he's released. I really don't blame him for deciding to go abroad. When does his next legal problem turn up? He's in the United States. He asked for asylum.
Mm-hmm. He applied for asylum, and then his case pends, right? So he applied mm-hmm. for it administratively. Which basically means that this is not a defensive application where he was placed in deportation proceedings. He applied affirmatively for asylum with the U.S. government, and the case wasn't adjudicated for many years. And during his time in the U.S., while his application was pending, he had work authorization, so he, through Scholars Rescue Fund, got a position. He was teaching French in Pennsylvania, and then he got a lecture position at Montclair University in New Jersey. And mm-hmm. while he was there at Montclair, he was asked to speak about the events in Rwanda in April of 1994. Uh-huh. And so he gave a speech at the University of Delaware on October 25th of 2006. And then subsequently, on November 15th of 2006, he gave a similar presentation at Montclair. And during his presentation, he opined that the horrible events that took place in Rwanda were better described as a fratricide rather than a genocide.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, there wasn't a lot that happened. And then a couple of years later, I mean, factually, we know now that on November 10th of 2006, the Rwandan government issued an international arrest warrant for him, charging him for the first time with acts of genocide in April of 94 and also genocide negation. But nothing really happened with that. In fact, Mr. Munyakazi doesn't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't find out about this until January of 2009 when he is arrested by DHS, by the Department of Homeland Security, in his home.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, maybe December of 2008, actually, because apparently NBC, the National Broadcasting Corporation, was working on a special show. And they were also working with the Rwandan prosecutor, and they contacted Goucher about these allegations that the Rwandan government had made, because in October of 2008, the Rwandans issued another warrant with the same charges.
Mm-hmm.
And so once this came out is when the Department of Homeland Security denied his asylum claim, took him into custody briefly, and then put him out on a bracelet and put him into deportation proceedings where he could reapply or renew his application for asylum.
Oh, so he's been wearing this new thing called the bracelet for mm-hmm. during this time, but now he's actually in custody awaiting a situation where they intend to remove him. Is that right?
That's correct.
How long has he been in that situation?
The week Friday before Labor Day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very familiar with that because that was the weekend I had to spend here in the office.
Yeah.
So yeah, they came on the Friday before Labor Day, and they took him into custody, indicating that they were that his deportation was going to be imminent. I mean, that's the only reason to arrest him, because obviously, since that 2009 arrest, since they took him into custody through today or through the day of their arrest, now obviously, Mr. Munyakazi has complied with every single one of their requirements: the bracelet, the check-ins, the compliance. I'm in Fairfax, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. and he lives in Towson, or lived in Towson. And for him to cross over into Virginia to meet with me, he would tell ICE, I'm going to cross over into Virginia to meet with my lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So he's complied the entire time. Throughout his entire case, we've done nothing but comply with DHS.
Uh-huh.
And then they decided on that weekend that they were going to arrest him and begin the process of deportation.
Yeah, you know, it's so patent here that he gave a speech which was out of sync with the present leadership in Rwanda. It's not, by the way, it is not out of sync at all with a number of prominent and highly respected scholars, Professor Renschens, for one, and who often testifies for the prosecutor in cases. And then, of course, we have people like Paul Rusesabagina. He's been mm-hmm. on this program, known from Hotel Rwanda. He has said practically the same things as your client, probably had a slightly different tack, I don't know. We've had people like the former Prime Minister, Faustin Togiri-Mungu, who I'm sure is highly sympathetic with your client, and would say, clearly this is a political matter having to do with a government wishing to silence somebody. I mean, he gives a speech, and then he gets charged with a crime when they had him in custody for 5 years and produced witnesses who said he didn't do it.
That's correct.
I know of cases that went before the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda where people were charged and there were no witnesses yet. So they got charged, and then they went and found the witnesses. Now, I understand that somebody, an investigator or an agent of the U.S. government, went to Rwanda and spoke to people who were themselves under charge. Is that right? And then ended up with information against your client?
Yes. I mean, the indictments, the 2006 and the 2008 indictments, were based on new testimony. And the vast majority of the – and they said this, right? So they provided those names as well. So once this came out, yes, a special agent from DHS, and probably, I'm sure more than one, went to Rwanda and interviewed these alleged witnesses, who the majority of which were, in fact, convicted genocidaires.
Well, and by the way,
I always, of course, found very odd that, now, you know, the system – I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
No, please, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no. I mean, one of the recurring themes in this proceedings is, you know, we've actually had two trials and two appeals already, was, I mean, the use of this information, where, you know, the reliance on these witnesses who, for me, the coincidental nature of, like, I don't understand. I mean, everyone knows that in Rwanda, that if you want to get a shorter sentence, then it's best to roll on someone else. I mean,
it is absolutely essential. You must produce three names, is my understanding from other interviews.
I'm not, mm-hmm. And I don't think that I'm saying anything that people don't know, right? Mm-hmm. People who are in the know about how the system works in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. So something that I found to be, that I just couldn't get over was the fact that you have these convicted genocidaires who have been in jail for I don't know how long. We don't know how long. And that was a question that I asked a special agent. Like, did you ask them this question? And, you know, isn't it odd? Didn't you find it odd that they didn't say anything about this alleged action in 1994 or 1995 or 1996 mm-hmm. or 1997 or 1998? And then magically, they're suddenly recalling that Mr. Munyakazi was heading up some, you know, this big genocide action in Kirwa. Mm-hmm. But they're not giving you this information is coming in 2006, which is 12 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And completely contrary to the evidence that they got in 1988, 1999, much more contemporaneous to the alleged event.
Yeah, their memories have improved as they sat in jail.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's, well, I really hope that there's further legal steps. I understand that you have, is it the Fourth Circuit that you have a brief that you expect to be heard? Can we hope that he'll be with us still at that point?
I don't know the answer to that.
One could hope, couldn't we, that a court objectively looking at that would say there's something wrong with this case. He didn't have any accusers when he was in their custody for 5 years and when he was not given a trial and when he then was released.
One would hope.
Yeah, so this is a dubious thing.
I mean, it was shocking to me at the immigration court level. I mean, it was shocking to me then that, I mean, you know, there are maybe, you know, of the 22 alleged witnesses that the agent interviewed, there were like two or three that were random. But their testimony was very vague and again, not consistent with, the testimony wasn't consistent with their own testimony, and it wasn't consistent, again, with the witnesses from 1998 and 1999. And, I mean, I think, you know, even then in the immigration court, obviously that was a shocker because, you know, that's the place, I guess the issue with the federal court is this, right? Uh-huh. I mean, when you're at the trial level, that is the point where the trial judge is looking, I mean, these witnesses are testifying directly in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing all of that.
Yes.
And at the Fourth Circuit, at the federal level, at this level of appeal, we have to demonstrate that the substantial evidence test, that a reasonable trier of fact would not come to the same conclusion as the immigration judge.
That's
a difficult standard. And
yes.
It's kind of an interesting question because, obviously, when you think about saying that someone has committed genocide,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, in this country, under our justice system, you better be sure.
Yes.
Because you're sentencing this man to death.
Yes. Well,
the
indeed.
The standard is not beyond a reasonable doubt in immigration court.
Yeah. And by the way, it's really quite a celebrated fact that this government has broadly accused anyone that criticizes them of exactly the same thing they're accusing your client of. And I just wonder, doesn't it, someone along the line, certainly up the line to the State Department, they've been known to interfere in cases. But, for example, to consider the findings of organizations like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, they're the leading elements on the African file, and those organizations have all said that you cannot get a fair trial on this issue.
Yeah.
No matter who you are, the way they operate, it's not going to happen. Plus, you have a regime there that even the U.S. government worried about its tendency to murder its opponents, both domestic in the country, but certainly abroad. We had the celebrated case of Patrick Karegeo, who was strangled to death in South Africa because
mm-hmm.
he was a critic.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that
how can you turn an individual over to to that state?
I don't know. I mean, what's more shocking, I think, to me, I mean, about the case, I think the shocking part, you know, the asylum claim is the asylum claim. I don't want to get into. You know, I don't want to get too far into the weeds on the law, but, I mean, you have the asylum portion where you have to demonstrate that this person has a reasonable fear of persecution,
mm-hmm.
but that person is barred if there's evidence that indicates that he is a human rights persecutor, which is what happened here.
Yes.
And then you have secondary applications, like withholding of removal and deferral. Convention Against Torture, we're a party to that. And I think that is the most shocking. Obviously, I believe my client is entitled to asylum, but more shocking to me is that is the finding that he wouldn't be subject to torture upon return to Rwanda. There's no dispute that he'll be taken into custody by the Rwandan government. None.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I find it most shocking that a court would find that he's not going to be subject to torture with exactly the type of information that we know about the regime and about conditions on the ground in Rwanda.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, there are states that say, well, if that's the accusation, and we don't believe you have the appropriate a way to go about this, and that did happen in the case, there have been a couple of cases in Canada where the Canadian government brought the charges. And one, by the way, they had an acquittal. It took many years, but they got the acquittal. But to turn somebody over to a system where there's no confidence seems pretty irregular. I hope that Amnesty and Human Rights Watch and others will sound the alarm. This shouldn't happen.
Well, I mean, certainly they've reported on conditions in Rwanda. I mean, they've been very specific recently on particular types of jails, military, et cetera. I mean, I would note that, you know, when this first case, when this case first got started, you know, interestingly, there was Alison DeForge, who, you know, passed away and was like a really well-known Rwanda expert. And early on, unfortunately, you know, she passed away before this case really got going, but she actually had reviewed at least a portion of this and had stated at some point that it, that the allegations of the Rwandan government weren't consistent with previous reports that HRW had done and on Mr. Munyakazi's history, right, like on who he had been associated with prior to the events of April of 1994.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean...
Mm-hmm. You've made a great fight for him, and I think the argument is so rather clear to any with anyone who comes at it fresh. We could really hope for that you will get that, that your brief will get the respect it deserves, and I hope everyone will speak up about this. There is, I should tell our listeners, people can read about this case and I know at anngarrison.com, and there is a Twitter account, twitter.com/saveLeopold, and I urge everyone to go to read the articles by Ann Garrison, and of course to go to twitter.com/saveLeopold. Ms. Calderon, I thank you again for the work you've done. I think Munyakazi really not only does he of course need to be here and safe, but I think everybody ought to listen to what he has to say because he's a fairly substantial intellectual who's clearly he said something that scared the government of Rwanda.
That seems clear
because,
to me also.
Because he's a very competent individual. Well, thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you again, and thank you, Phil, for having me. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. You're listening to Taylor Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM. And I tell you, you can, of course, check us on the web at Taylor-Report.com, and of course we're at Facebook/TheTaylorReport. And as Phil was saying earlier, you can still and I agree with him. We were very grateful for all the support. We did an outstanding work, I think. And I'm speaking of you, the listeners. There was a lot of support for our program, so we're very grateful. And of course the station is doing very well. It shows that across the board, this is a great community station, community radio. When every time you turn on the radio and go to 89.5 FM, you're going to get a good program. We promise you that.